Welcome back to episode 119 of Rising Giants with your hosts Max Thornton and Dominic Klusik, where we explore the world of innovation and entrepreneurship in Cambodia and the Southeast Asia region, releasing a new episode every Wednesday. This week, we have the pleasure of speaking with Eling Lim. Eling heads up 500 Global's market launch team, overseeing the development and implementation of startup programs for 500 and its partners all over the world, from Egypt and Canada to Japan and Taiwan. In her role, she works with various ecosystem stakeholders, such as governments, corporations, foundations, and startups, to accelerate their innovation journey. Additionally, Eling is the co-founder of Smarter Me and Young Founders Summit, platforms dedicated to democratizing entrepreneurial mindset and skill set among Generation Z worldwide. Before venturing into the startup ecosystem, Eling accumulated nearly a decade of experience as an investment banker specializing in high-value transactions in M&A, equity, and debt capital markets with a focus on consumer, retail, and technology sectors. Be sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review on our channel as it helps us continue to grow within the region and around the world. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Great. Eling, welcome to Rising Giants. You are the co-founder of Young Founders Summit, as well as Smarter Me. So just to begin the podcast, it would be great to discuss kind of what set the foundation for you being an entrepreneur and kind of how you find yourself doing what you're doing today.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was actually just at a talk the other day, Max and Dom, and thanks so much for having me on this podcast. But I was at this talk the other day and I realized that there's two classes of founders, right? There are ones who say, I grew up in a family of entrepreneurs and I could just never imagine working for someone else. I always knew I had to set something up. I was the opposite, the other camp. I never thought of myself as an entrepreneur, never, you know, had that deep desire to do so as well. In fact, like every other good Asian kid, I started my career out in finance. So I was investment banking because according to my dad, that's where the money is. And so I started in investment banking, did that for about 10 years. And it reached a stage where I felt that I was dying a little inside. I loved what I was doing, but I felt that I wasn't learning enough, nor was I really enriching or empowering someone else's life. And as bankers as well, you're kind of trained to look at the facts so much and the stats so much that there's no making up things, you know? And you're so obsessed with that process, the facts and the stats, that I think you forget about a lot of other things. You forget about lifelong learning. And I think that's really what made me feel that I can't be doing this any longer. And around the same time as well, you know, serendipitously, I started fundraising as part of my banking role. Started fundraising for a couple of consumer retail companies turned startups, you know, kind of thing. And in that encounters itself, I was looking at founders who were so excitable. They were so excited at this innovation that they were doing, how they were disrupting the industry. And I just felt that that's kind of where I wanted to be in. To be surrounded by people like that who's excited. And that's when I decided to leave and launch my own startup. I, of course, did like the part and parcel thing first, you know, like tried to build it on the side, but it didn't quite work out after 6 months. So I decided to take a plunge, leave banking, and then go full on into the startup itself. But because of my interest always has been in consumer retail and healthcare, it was where I entered in that eventually was edutech. It's also an area that I grew up being really interested in. My mom was a teacher. Since young, I had, you know, taught people art and craft and different things itself. So it felt very natural that also the problem that I found was in the education space. And that's why I also, when I left, I went on to start a education startup. Yeah. And that is Young Founders Summit and Smarter Me. And so today we equip the next generation with the skill set, mindset, and heart set for the future, focusing on number one, entrepreneurial skills, critical thinking, but also on discovering themselves. What is the meaning and purpose? Where are their strengths and skills? And why are they here? And what are they meant to be doing?
Great. And what's it been like with both those startups? What's been like some of the milestones along the way? How many countries do you work in and how many sort of events and programs do you put on in a given year?
Yeah, so the primary programs that we started off with a B2C model and today we do more B2B and B2G. And those, you know, we run a couple of cohorts a year, primarily in Singapore. That's our largest market itself. And that's under Smarter Me. For Young Founders Summit, we actually have students from more than 12 countries joining us every single year. So we run one cohort per year. The program is about 6 months long. So it's really an incubator program. And if you're familiar with Entler, I think that's the easiest way to kind of explain it is Entler, but for high school students. So we bring students in, about 70, 80 of them from more than 10 countries across Asia. Our further students came from Romania and Kazakhstan. Yeah, but otherwise Greater Asia itself, they come in, they form teams, they get mentorship and then some support and funding, and then they launch the startups. And so it's 6 months. We're currently in our fifth cohort.
Okay. And do you have any sort of examples of some of the startups that have been founded that have gone on to do big things and raise, you know, larger rounds and such?
Yeah. Given that they are high school students, and we iterated a few times. So when we first started out, they were much younger. We took students in from them when they were 12 and kept it when they were 17. Our latest cohort ranges from 15 to 20 years old. So I think we'll see more success stories. But it also depends on what the definition of success is. And to me, it is not about raising the round because they are younger. I look at nurturing how many students go on to, in your words, right, do great things. And to me, that is either they continue educating other students and increasing the appetite towards entrepreneurship, or they continue doing something entrepreneurial. So it's a long way of really saying that, has any student continued building a startup that they entered in with and then now as they're doing it? No. But there are many of them who have gone on to, for example, one of our founders, she was 12 when she first joined Young Founders Summit, and she is, well, 18 today, right? And she's actually set up a secondhand children's bookstore in Hong Kong. She's a RISE Global founder under the Eric Schmidt Foundation and has just gotten so many awards itself. We have another founder from India who got the Princess Diana Award for, you know, change makers in the world. We have a couple of students who's gone on to join other programs as well in the US, and one being the Diamond Challenge. So I think a lot of them continue building stuff and doing stuff. And to me, like, that's a great indicator.
And in the selection process, what are some of the characteristics that you look out for? And then once students are in the program, what are some of the characteristics that you like to cultivate or try and have the students embrace at such an early age? I feel like that's a really interesting way to think about how to set up, how to set the foundation as a founder. So it would be great to learn some of those characteristics.
Yeah, we get asked that a lot as well. And again, it's an iteration, right? When we first started Young Founders Summit, we took them in as teams. So we focused very much on how you would evaluate the startup. We looked at their pitch deck, whether this is the right market for them, how do they plan to execute it, so on and so forth. In the recent iteration, we looked at founders first, because what we realized is that when we take in the team, oftentimes there's one person who's really driven, and the rest are just the friends who tagged along. So this time around, we looked at selecting really independently people who wanted to found something and wanted to start something. And we looked at, number one is really, do they have a problem that they care about? So during the interview process, we interview them one by one. Is there a problem that they really care about? They don't have to come in with an idea, but why is that the problem they care about? But the second thing that we ask and we go deeply into is, to get them to tell us about a time when they've been so obsessed with learning something or like doing something that they just went all in into that. And we've got kids who came and said, I was morbidly overweight and my obsession was in losing weight and working out. And we've got people who said, I was really obsessed with just learning about the Enneagram and the MBTI. And I just went down a rabbit hole trying to figure and type everyone out, including my friends. And that kind of obsession is kind of what we look for. When we run the program, though, because I do get mentors to come and mentor the students, especially from the business point of view, right, sales, marketing, so on and so forth, where I personally like to mentor and guide them the most is more on team dynamics. And it's more around how you work together. How do you understand each other? How do you align on your purpose and your vision? And so even as they come and they think about an idea, we drill into them, we ask them, why is this the problem you want to solve? Because you don't have domain expertise at that point in time. So it's just something that you care deeply about. And we want to make sure that it's not because the government says that this is an important topic to build on, right? But it's rather why, right? Why do you care about this truly? And we try and figure that out. So over time as well, when they find other team members, they find that the conflict starts, you know, they're not at school. And as teachers, I'm like, I'm not going to mediate. I'm not going to tell you to say sorry to you. But you come and you understand what are the differences, where are the triggers? Why are you acting a certain way? What's underlying, you know, what's the underlying point of all this conflict that's happening? And then I coach them on how to figure that out.
Wow. Yeah. I love that idea of that realization of, have you had a prior passion and how can you channel that passion to be able to build something, to build a business? And also realizing what is the reason for why you're doing what you're doing. And it's kind of crazy to think about it at such an early age too, right? I mean, and it's great that the support system around these students with mentors that are proficient in so many different areas of business are also helping build that foundation is a really interesting concept to think about. In terms of just overall, and as you mentioned, you have students that come from all over the world, maybe in some areas that are more developed, some areas that are less developed. What would you say some of the infrastructure and support that are needed for, you know, new and emerging startup ecosystems to be successful?
Yeah. And I know we've been talking more about my role as a founder of Young Founders Summit so far, but my day job is actually as executive director of market launch at 500 Global. So 500 Global is a Silicon Valley started, originated venture capital fund. We've invested in over 2,800 companies. We've got about 40 unicorns under our belt, including big names like Grab, Canva, right? And a few more in the region itself. So at 500 Global, I lead the market launch team where we go into different countries, especially emerging ecosystems, and we launch accelerator programs. Some of them are investment-based programs, some are non-investment-based programs. But essentially, really looking at, you know, what we really believe in is that founders exist everywhere. Talent exists everywhere, but opportunities do not. So we go into all these emerging markets and look for the most talented founders itself. So it's interesting that you asked me the question about ecosystem development, because at 500, for example, one of the more active markets that we're in right now is Egypt and Georgia, the country. But we've also done programs in Asia, primarily everywhere from Japan, Taiwan, Korea, which you may think, I mean, sounds like a developed market, but we will call it a high income rising market in terms of startup economy itself, right? And then, of course, we've also done programs in Philippines, in Cambodia, Singapore, and Malaysia too. And at 500, we have a structure that we call the Eco6, which means what do you need in order for a startup ecosystem to develop itself? And the six factors are government. So you're talking about regulations. You're talking about startup performance. So PayPal Mafia is something that's really, you know, a famous term. But here in Southeast Asia, people probably look at the C Group Mafia. And that's so important because you need that first wave or second wave of startups to grow, for the founding team to have some exit, and then they come out and do something of their own. In fact, one of my friends actually was a CTO of a Series B, Series C fintech company, and he's just left to start his own fintech company. I think we're going to see more and more of that. So second is startup performance. The third one is market reach. Is there appetite for venture-built startups? Is there appetite for all these innovative tech startups, right? Not just from a investment perspective, but also from a consumer perspective. And that's really important. Do you also have corporates? If you're a B2B business, you also have corporates that will support and partner with you on your product. The fourth one is talent. I definitely think that this is probably the most important thing, and we could dive a little bit deeper as well. But talent, talent, talent. In whatever sector that you're looking for to grow in, talent is the biggest bottleneck, both for the economy and also individually for every company itself. The fifth one is platform. Is there mentorship available? Is there basically support, you know, perks, right, that's available for the startup? And then sixth, the last one is investment. Not just from every level itself, right? Do you have venture debt available? Do you have government grants available? Do you have the angel network? And then do you have VCs at different stages itself? So all six elements are required to be present in order for a startup ecosystem to really grow and develop. So every time when we enter into a new market itself, we make sure that we bring, first and foremost, is this the right market for us to invest in? We definitely look at the government policies, the startup performance itself, and the market opportunity itself. But what we then bring in would be not just investments, but also the platform, the mentoring and the education itself. But, you know, I kind of shared a little bit about like that talent piece, right? I think ultimately whether a what we think, and we've actually just recently at 500 released a report called the Rise 30 report last year, and we split up into basically the 30 economies that we believe are rising in the next few years. Half of them would be the high income rise economies, and half of them would be like the middle income rise economies. And honestly, fundamentally, you know, is a startup ecosystem going to be developed? I think it really depends on the fundamentals of the country and the economy itself, the business fundamentals, right? Would you build this, and can this be built, and can this be sustained if there is no VC money in it? So in middle income, especially, and this is relevant for Southeast Asia, what's probably really needed is like mobile payment. So you need the economy to be highly social, highly connected, really have pretty high adoption of mobile and e-payments itself, because that drives so many other solutions that could come up. And I think that's what we're seeing in places like Philippines, where before COVID, people were not using mobile payments. But after COVID, GCash became really so dominant that everyone has a GCash account. And with that, you then see the opportunity for other solutions, other tech startups to come up as well.
Yeah, maybe just diving into that, the talent mm-hmm. piece in a little bit more detail. What would you say the kind of founder profiles are and some of the characteristics of founders that differ from market to market? Like, let's say dealing with a Cambodian founder versus dealing with, you know, a Japanese founder, for example.
Oh, I feel like we can go on for this forever. That's a question I ask teams a lot, and my team members a lot as well, which is, tell me the difference, right, between these different founders itself. How shall I put this also a little bit tactfully? Okay. Maybe I'll address it two ways, right? One is really more the experience and expertise that they bring on, like the profile. Demographics is a profile of the founder itself. And then the second one is really the mindset. And I think the second one is so, so important. So the first one, the profile itself, I think that's where that nurture thing comes up a little bit in terms of the different nations itself. Why do I say that? In Egypt, for example, we see more founders actually being older, and because of their lived experience in different sectors itself, and also the economy of where Egypt is, the startups that they tend to build would be what we would call more tech-enabled startups. So they're not tech-first or tech-native, they're tech-enabled startups. So you would take like a traditional SME or all business, and you put a tech element to it. And yes, you improve efficiency and everything, but those are the businesses that we see, you know, e-commerce platforms, even like AI enabled, but like, you know, cake decorating sites or things like that. That's what we kind of see in Egypt. But the founders are much more stable, much more matured. They and definitely know the local market very well, you know, and that's their approach to it. Then if we contrast it with Georgia, which is the other country that we're in. And in Georgia, we have founders from all across the EECCA region. So we have founders from Armenia, from Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, so on and so forth, Azerbaijan. And in that, the profiles are much younger. So you have these individuals who either were schooled locally or globally in the US, came back much younger in nature, they're in their 20s, and then they're building tech for startups. So now the startups that we're seeing are generally AI native or, you know, AI enabled kind of startups itself. And then you have the, if you look at Korea and Japan, generally, they are mid-level professionals, worked in a large corporate. Oh, also two kinds. You either have the returning overseas ones who want to jump right in, but most of the time, they come from corporates and then they leave and they want to start something. So to them, I think there's a little bit of mindset shift between real stability and then taking the plunge and doing this itself. In Cambodia, and similarly in many parts of Southeast Asia itself, what we feel is that founders are innovative, they are entrepreneurial, they jump into opportunities very quickly. But one thing that, and this is just an observation, right? It might be pretty generalized as well, but an observation is that they don't just pivot, but rather they switch very quickly. So it's like, this one doesn't work out, quickly move on, set up another different company or same company, or, you know, start doing slightly different stuff. And that moves happen. And it's not uncommon. We've seen that a lot happening in Vietnam too. But yeah, that's kind of like a profile that we see, I think. Whereas in some of these other countries, maybe while they understand the meaning of pivoting, the need to also continue trying to make this work, this same startup work, is very, very important to them, because also reputation with their stakeholders, investors is everything. So dropping the name and switching to a different company and business, I think happens a little bit fewer. I think the second one is the mindset piece. And that's the biggest one that we always try and crack, which is the risk-taking mindset. in places like Japan, for example, a big push right now for the government is to expose the founders or the aspiring founders to the Silicon Valley way of doing things. And that's either by getting your US-based mentors to come, founders to come and expose, or actually bringing the Japanese startup over to the US, transplanting them, having them be immersed in the environment and realizing that, gosh, this is the atmosphere here. This is how fast people build. You know, this is what is needed in order to move quickly and to make this happen. So gradually, I think a lot of that emphasis is being put on how do we shift that mindset quickly.
Yeah. Okay, maybe just a follow up there. Like, do you then like adapt your accelerators that you launch in these countries, like, you know, as time goes on, according to kind of some of these dynamics, and how do you kind of think about that versus, like, as you were saying, the Southeast Asia versus somewhere like Japan versus Egypt?
Yeah. We do to some extent, and why I say that is because in terms of curriculum, it's quite similar. But where we do alterations has to do a lot with, yes, the founder psyche itself. For Japan, for example, and where it's possible, we do find that immersion, it's quite an interesting approach. Now, this is different from the first wave of like what we call the innovation zoo. Everyone goes to Silicon Valley, they go visit Google and Meta and everything, and then they come back. And that's like a zoo, right? They're just visiting, you know, the offices itself. But to us, immersion doesn't just mean going there and sitting in the room itself, but it's really being surrounded and networking with the local founders. And because of 500's presence, generally in any point in time, we have founders from different parts of the world at our Palo Alto office. We have a program running in Canada, for example, and we do cross-program pollination. So where we can bring them together, we sometimes would have the Canadian cohort or the Korean cohort, the Japanese cohort, kind of coming together and interacting with each other. That kind of immersion, because you're the average of the six people you surround yourself with, right? And we've heard so many founders go there, come back and tell us, like, I thought we were hardworking, and I look at them and I'm like, oh my God, this is a different level, right? And that's what I aspire to be. You're just energized. And people generally get motivation. I mean, this is scientifically proven. You get motivation when you are surrounded by challenge and effort and being able to overcome that. And I think seeing that and experiencing that itself is very important. So where we can, we try and do that. And where it's needed, not just where we can, but where it's needed, we try and do that. In other programs, though, what the founders need might be very different. We've heard anecdotally, and we haven't launched this yet, but we've heard anecdotally that in Africa, for example, some of the founders, a lot of the founders are entrepreneurs because they have to. That's the only way they can bring their family out of poverty, of changing the future of their family itself. And so they become entrepreneurs, even though they're not fully convinced or sure that they have what it takes. And so in those places, what we're looking then to do is to provide different kind of founder coaching, right? It's all about the removing imposter syndrome, all about empowering and making sure that they believe and see that ability in themselves itself. And then in some other markets, you have founders who, like I mentioned a bit earlier on, might feel that this is an ego thing. I need to make this work. And then they are burnt out. They're carrying all the stress on their own. They can't even talk to maybe their co-founders because they might be the only ones in charge of the financials, and knowing how dire it is, they don't want to stress anyone out, and they're carrying all that burden, right? And for those programs itself, we actually do include a founder coaching session too. So a lot about everything from like burnout to how do you build a team culture? How do you take care of yourself, right? How do you have habits and rituals so that you show up, not just for your team, but really for yourself? And how do you keep healthy that way? So yeah, we do kind of like, we have this like 80-20 rule where we do change up some of the program components itself.
You mentioned going back to the immersion piece where there are, sometimes it's needed. Where do you see the time when it's needed, and maybe specifically in what markets?
Mm-hmm. Japan is definitely one because of the lower risk-taking appetite. Culturally, everyone aspires to work for a large corporate because there's stability in there. And so everyone from your grandparents, your parents would tell you that you don't go and start a startup. And even when you're talking about like market reach, being able to speak to corporates, to the customers itself, the risk appetite is typically very low. So the way that they are thinking of building businesses as well is different. And I mean, infrastructure-wise as well. For the longest time, and this is only now changing, Korea and Japan had personal liability laws linked to you starting a company. What it means is that if your company actually fails, it's your personal liability. You may be declared a bankrupt. It's not just your company. You can't differentiate that. So you have to give personal guarantees, personal loans as well. So there's really a lot at risk. So it's usually markets like that where the risk-taking appetite is a bit lower. And I think the understanding of working hard and taking risks is like slightly different. Yeah. For others, some other markets, the immersion may come for a different purpose, and that could be to look at talent, to understand what else is out there, yeah, and what people are building.
Something that you've been mentioning throughout the when talking about different markets too is, and it's come up with companies is AI, and it feels like AI enabled products and solutions. This is like the coolest thing on the block. You know, everybody wants a piece of it, sort of deal. But I'm just curious, is that particularly where you think is the one market that's the most exciting right now, sector that's the most exciting right now, or are there other sectors that you feel like are also emerging and maybe are kind of in the shadows of AI, so to speak, at this time?
Yeah, it's funny about that, how you said it, right? It's like the cool thing right now. And honestly, in 2022, I went down the rabbit hole of blockchain and Web3, launched my own NFT and launched my own DAO as well, right before the crash and everything like that. So
wait, are you a degen? Are you?
No. I'm definitely not a degen. But that just resonated because we talk about waves, right, of all these trends itself. And you're right, I definitely think AI is the big thing right now in terms of our global accelerator program. Similar to YC, majority of the startups in there are AI. We also recently did quite a few big, in fact our latest big investment in Japan is also an AI company, which is really exciting. I can dive a little bit deeper, but I mean, we are very thoughtful about how we look at AI, right? Because AI, you have the core AI, so four categories, right? Your core AI, your AI infrastructure, your AI hardware, and your AI applications. And of course, AI hardware is not something that we play in. AI infrastructure is a little bit harder, but our recent investment is called Sakana AI in Japan, founded by, you know, the last remaining person from the Google research paper who had not founded a startup, but now has, right? So Google Brain and Google Research. So that's one that we invested in from an AI kind of like core algorithm perspective. But of course, we do a lot of AI applications too. And here, I think what we want to try and make sure is that we distinguish between AI native versus AI powered. And we pay very close attention to, again, are you just building on OpenAI and finding like any generic use cases? And you may have initial traction, you know, in terms of people adopting it. One startup that we actually saw was like a PDF analyzer, and they had initial traction from researchers and lawyers itself, but the real use case hasn't quite been built up. Versus another one, which is kind of like a Salesforce, but AI first. Right, AI native kind of Salesforce, that one is a lot more interesting. So we look at AI applications where they have very, very specific use case and hence is defensible. And we do think that that is an area that we want to continue investing in itself. That being said, 500 is always sector agnostic. So we still look at a lot of different sectors itself. I think that's where the different markets come into play. In countries where early on I talked about the rise to the economies, in countries which are higher income rise economies, we notice that it's always SaaS who becomes unicorns first, right? And SaaS who succeeds. And so in those countries, we still invest a lot in SaaS platforms, SaaS solutions. But then in the rising economies, the lower income rising economies itself, it's still e-commerce, it's still fintech. So in those markets, we still invest a lot in logistics, in fintech and HR, things like that. And I think that's what we're seeing, for example, in Georgia and Egypt. So we don't run away from that, of course. And we also try and avoid, you know, just investing in startups because they put an AI word, right, in their pitch deck or in their description itself. The other one that I feel not hopeful, but I wish would continue on is really climate tech, right? We've seen it come up before COVID, and then during COVID kind of come down as people focus on, you know, profitability and they drop like the whole ESG and climate kind of thing. Now it's rising again. We saw, you know, UAE announced that they want to set up a $30 billion fund. In Singapore, we also have a Temasek Foundation running this Amplifier program, which we're helping out with. And we've also seen a few new funds like Radical Fund come up in Southeast Asia and is actively, and in fact, their mandate says we're only going to invest in Asian climate tech companies, right? And I do definitely hope that we see more resilience in those space and more commitment to that space itself, because that's definitely what we need for the future.
Yeah, the two very exciting sectors. And honestly, if we had more time, maybe this will have to be another conversation, but it'll be great to dive more into your NFT project and learn about how you immerse yourself into the Web3 world. In terms of going, you mentioned about kind of more of like frontier markets. And specifically with us, you know, basing out of Cambodia, you know, what was your experience, or what's been the experience working in frontier economies to do accelerator work like Cambodia, for example? You know, what are some of the key pieces of getting the momentum needed in that and ecosystems like that?
Are you talking mainly around the accelerator models, the investment models, or what?
Yeah, more of the accelerator models.
I'll be really honest with you. I don't think we cracked Cambodia at all. And there are a lot of markets in which we went in and realized that this model may not be what is needed. I also feel that what I've realized running this for many years is that it's an evolution. And even in Silicon Valley, it's also an evolution as well. In fact, even more so in the current climate where fundraising market is pretty tough and a lot of startups can't actually fundraise, the demand for accelerators has increased. But what that meant is that a lot of pure VCs who only did pure investing before have also established their own accelerator programs. And that then creates, you know, whether you call it competition or not, but it creates competition for 500 for YC, and we're then on Techstars and we're relooking also at our model. Right? How do we continue providing outsized support and value to these founders itself? So I started there, which is like the most developed startup ecosystem and how that's also evolving. And all I can say is if I look at this part of the world and the emerging markets itself, it's still experimentation. And honestly, I'm not averse to that. That's one thing that we do a lot in our team, which is keep experimenting with programs. Okay, but just to provide a bit more context on why I say it's an experiment, right? Seriously, if you were to draw that like graph itself, and then you plot every single country and their government and like where they are and where they evolve, everyone pretty much follows the same line and same trend. So I can pretty much take what Singapore is doing or has done and go and speak to another country's government, and it's like you will follow that same trajectory itself. So for accelerators, I mean, obviously in emerging markets itself, and I'll say Middle East for an example, right? Because they are so cash rich and there are enough founders, you start out with accelerator. But you also reach a point where you realize that you've just exhausted the entire pool itself, and you now need to go earlier, right? Downstream, you need to go at the incubator level. That's where like people like Antler comes in. So you need to, in fact, not just go at aspiring founders. You're not just looking for like professionals and convincing them to become founders, but you need to go to the school level as well, the university level, train them up to continue providing and creating that pool itself. And so sooner or later, you'll basically have enough incubators, accelerators, scale-up programs, and then also market access programs. So that's what we see, because once the ecosystem is mature enough, or in markets where the local market is small, market expansion is super important. But again, as we all know, just because you're a Singaporean company doesn't mean you know how to expand into Cambodia or into Japan or wherever that is, right? It takes a lot of thought into that itself. So we see all of that. But beyond those, I would say are same. They are like accelerator education models and mentorship models, but just at different life cycles itself. The other thing I've also noticed is just the thesis on increasing success rates and exits. If we think of governments, what they are interested in is how do I create more investments, foreign direct investments in this ecosystem? How do we create more jobs? So what they're looking for is the success rates and the exits of the startups itself. So yes, you have the incubator accelerator model, which really looks at, do I have the right founder? Are they solving the right problem? Can I help them supercharge their growth by providing mentorship? Then we have the second one where people are like, maybe that's not the right way. Maybe let's look at corporate innovation and encourage more of that, because corporate innovation and corporate venture studios, they have, it's like distribution driven innovation, right? They have an unfair advantage of already having customers handy. So just creating new solutions internally. Maybe that's the model that could work and they could spin it off. They could hire an independent CEO, et cetera, et cetera. Now I'm seeing more and more countries still move towards venture builder model as well. So venture studios, but this is now, you can either go tech-driven innovation, and that's where you have a lot of, I would say higher learning institutes with strong R&D teams, right, or strong research institutes itself, but who don't know how to commercialize. So tech-driven innovation, you take the tech, you set up a founding team, you go run and commercialize it. Or a venture builder in terms of the founder-driven innovation. I want to build startups at like Wavemaker Partners is one of it. I want to build startups in the climate space. I'm going to find like the best founders itself and I'm going to build it together. So I also see governments funding at different stages and changing their thesis around which model would work best in terms of that. And I wouldn't be surprised if more countries just continue kind of adopting that. What excites me though, and this is something that I've been like really eager to see for the longest time. I'm not sure if this actually makes sense, but in terms of countries just deciding where my USP is and focusing on that. So rather than have every country in Asia try to become the next Silicon Valley of Asia, and a lot of countries are fighting for that crown, everyone from Singapore to Japan to Korea and Taiwan, right? As now I start seeing that divergence by sectors, I guess, and like niche focus funds and investments and accelerators itself. So for example, Taiwan, you know, saying I'm going to focus actually on growing chip innovation. I mean, they've always been famous for semiconductors, right? So chip innovation. Singapore saying, I mean, they've always talked about deep tech as well, but now really going more and more into deep tech. And then you have, like Korea strong in AI and data. So I'm just really going to focus on that. So different countries identifying where are my talent, where are my inherent strengths, and then like doubling down on that sector itself. I think that'll be interesting to see. Yeah, and Japan manufacturing. Yeah.
Okay, great. And wanted to kind of begin the last section of the podcast as well. We wanted to just ask you a few interpersonal questions. What would you say some of your key habits are, like on a daily, weekly basis that, you know, keep you on the path that you're on?
Mm-hmm. I think I kind of alluded to this earlier. You probably caught a glimpse of it as well, but I'm a big, big fan of mentoring and coaching. So I generally would advise people if you think you need therapy, go for therapy. Therapy, mentorship, coaching. I just hope that people realize that those are really helpful tools and it doesn't say anything negative about you by going for those. So habits, I mean, that's a big thing that I do a lot about mindset reframing, a lot of reading on that. My morning habit is generally journaling and then I work out. I don't do meditate and I don't do cold plunges as well, but I do make sure I get sunlight daily. That's definitely one thing. And rather than meditating, I have a framework that I use called, you know, SNARL, right? So it's like stop, notice, accept, and reframe. A lot of people think like, I can't meditate, or I don't meditate because you need to like sit there and be still for a long period of time. But honestly, the big thing about that is just being able to stop, notice the feelings that's coming up in you, accepting that you are human and that's just normal for you to feel that way, and then reframing that itself. So that, books and podcasts, a lot of it too, but that kind of changes with seasons, you know. Depending on which season I'm in, the kind of books and podcasts that I read and listen to also changes.
Okay, great. And our traditional closing question we ask all of our guests is, what is the most important piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Oh, instead of answering advice, can I answer a different way, like quotes, like mantras that I have?
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's great.
Okay. So a lot of these mantras are like reminders, right? Mental reminders come from my own coaches too, or like podcasts that I listen to. And again, different times of my life, different ones speak out to me. So for me right now, there are really three big mental reminders that keeps coming to me. Because it's International Women's Day and because I then speak with a lot of young women and girls itself and also through Young Founders, I mean, we have a lot of girls. The imposter syndrome comes out a lot. So one of my favorite quotes to tell people is that, or to tell these girls and young women is that, you know, what if I fail? But oh, what if you fly? Right. A lot of times people think like, what if I fail? But I would tell them, well, what if you fly? So that's really a mental reminder also to myself. And that's my second one that's speaking to me this season, which is, are you playing to win or are you playing not to lose? With every decision that I take, every plunge that I think of taking or not taking, yeah, what's happening there? But my all-time favorite, and I say this to my team a lot, because anytime there is conflicts within, whether communications breakdown or conflicts, this is something that I always say and which is, we cannot control what happens to us, but we can control how we respond to it, right? Let's differentiate the fact from the stories that we are associating with those facts itself. This is not happening to you. is happening. Let it happen just by you. It's just something that's just passing by you. Yeah, so those are just mental reminders that I also remind myself, you know, every day when I'm facing life.
Great. Thank you for all of those. Yeah, on that note, we really want to thank you for taking the time to join us on Rising Giants today. It's been a really interesting conversation, learning about all the different startup ecosystems that you're part of. So thank you.
No, thanks for having me. Thanks, Max. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you.